So, good afternoon, Hillary.
Hello, how are you?
Not bad. Not bad at all.
Getting ready for Thanksgiving?
As Thanksgiving will look in the fall of COVID.
I'm still making the same exact menu. It's just there's going to be extra leftovers. That's
oh yeah. I am too. I mean, it's like I figure, well, I mean, it's I've already got Christmas decorations up. They've been up since Halloween,
which ordinarily I would be very upset about. But in 2020, I've decided not to be upset.
I would too. I really do not want to see Christmas decorations till after the turkey has been eaten.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the leftovers have to be gone too.
Right. Then I can stomach things. Then I can stomach Christmas decorations and stuff. But this year, I was just like, November 1st, I put Halloween stuff away and just started bringing out the Christmas stuff. And
let's just get the show on the road.
Well, the funny thing is I noticed neighbors have done the same thing. Like my neighborhood, many, many houses have Christmas lights up and they've had them up for several weeks now. Because I think everybody's like, yep, we need Christmas early.
Yeah, we need to just get this year over with. But it's so sad for me because I do, like, I think people want some Christmas cheer, but I also think people have this very strange idea that like, well, 2020 was awful, but it'll be 2021 soon and everything will be better. And I'm like,
just remember it's
looking that way.
Remember, it's always darkest right before it's pitch black.
It's true. And the other thing is that like, when I used to live in Pennsylvania and there was no sunshine, Christmas was really fun because you're like, oh, you see the first snow and there's music and there's lights and it's so wonderful and you feel so warm and cozy. And I had this idea when I first moved there that like, oh, it stops being cold, you know, like after Christmas-ish. And no, I learned very quickly that winter lasts in Pennsylvania, like into April.
Yeah, you're such a Californian.
Well, yeah, I didn't know. And I was like, around January, February, it'll just start to kind of warm up and slowly.
So in New York,
like, no, that's the coldest time.
Yeah, in New York, we used to have this January thaw. But then February, oh my God. Oh, I remember our last year in New York City. I remember April of that year was so cold.
Yeah.
So very, very cold. And yeah. I was like, I cannot leave soon enough.
Yeah, we had a huge snow in Pennsylvania on Easter one year. And we had snow one year even into May. And it's like, it's kind of, you get so depressed over it. And this is what I'm concerned about with COVID and everything is that people think like, oh, Christmas is going to make it better and then we'll be happy. And maybe we'll be like a little happy with the music, but all that's going to go away in January. And you're going to be cold in the dead of winter with this virus raging. And I don't think people have fully prepared for that darkness and sadness that's going to be happening. And gosh, we're 3 minutes in and I'm already doing the gloom, but I'm scared.
I'm keeping Christmas decorations up till Mardi Gras.
I support that. Again, ordinarily I'd have the decorations down by Epiphany, January 6th, they come down. Mm-hmm. Maybe they'll be around till Valentine's. I don't know.
I mean, you live in Mississippi.
From holiday to holiday.
I mean, it's Mardi Gras. A lot of houses in kind of the South around Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, they keep lights up until Mardi Gras. So,
yeah. I guess it's permissible.
But let's talk about Thanksgiving. So we're skipping over Thanksgiving here. We're just obsessing over
holidays.
But today we're going to talk about Thanksgiving, right? We're going to kind of try to delve into Thanksgiving and what it is and maybe what it isn't and where it comes from and kind of the imagination of Thanksgiving and maybe a little bit of where some of our traditions come from and hopefully a little bit about kind of controversies about Thanksgiving, why some people don't like maybe the way it's imagined or celebrated. Welcome to An Incomplete History.
I'm Hillary.
And I'm Jeff.
And we're your hosts for this weekly history podcast.
So, Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving. I want to...
So, what is... So what is what did Thanksgiving dinner look like for you growing up?
I hope I'm not going to offend anybody in my family who listens, but Thanksgiving was my least favorite holiday because the food was so disgusting.
What food? Give us the food first.
Turkey was dry and just terrible. I hated it. So we would go to my grandma's house, and my grandma is Italian, and she is not very good at cooking food that's not Italian food. So we would have turkey, we would have stuffing, we would have cranberry, like a can of cranberry sauce. Like you could still see the grooves in the cranberry, and it was just revolting. Like it was the worst meal, and I would be so sad. And my grandma used to make me mustachelli on the side. And so I would just eat mustachelli because it was just terrible. And like rolls that came, like busted biscuits that came out of like a, you know, one of those like rolls that you get at the store. It was just terrible. And since I've, you know, been an adult and learned how to cook, like I like Thanksgiving now because I'll actually like cook things from scratch and kind of, I don't know, just make it taste better. It was terrible. What about your Thanksgiving?
Well, what'd you have for dessert?
Pies. And my mom would make pies, and my mom is like the best pie maker ever.
What kind of pies?
And I'll fight someone. We would have pumpkin pie, apple pie, and I don't want to get in trouble for saying it wrong, but pecan pie or pecan pie. My mom would call it pecan pie.
Okay. All right. I mean, what did we have? I actually have pretty fond memories, although the turkey was never my favorite part because it was dry. The only part of the turkey that I found edible was the dark meat, which may be why that's still to this day what I actually prefer on the turkey, because it's, even if the turkey itself is overcooked, the dry meat is usually at least edible. Mm-hmm. We had stuffing or dressing. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole, if we can get a whole kind of argument about what that is or not.
There is a difference.
Growing up in the South, ours was based on cornbread. It was not based on bread cubes. It was cornbread based. So my mom would make like a big pan of cornbread, usually the day before, and then crumble it up and stuff. And it was, the stuffing was my favorite part.
Honestly. I love cornbread stuffing. Yes.
Like that was my favorite part. We would have the turkey, we'd have the stuffing. She'd make a gravy, a giblet gravy with all the little parts that come in the bag giblet. In the turkey. Yeah. Mm. And I was both horrified by that, but had been intrigued by it. I liked the way it tasted, but I didn't like the thought of what was in it. Plus just there was
the random word sounds naughty.
And there were random pieces of hard boiled egg in it as well, which was odd. I still don't understand that, but it kind of worked.
Do you do that? Do you carry that tradition?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. Cause you put a big mound of stuffing and then you put some dark turkey meat on top of it and then you smother it with the gravy. And you got little
hard boiled eggs.
Yeah. You got some little egg in there and you got some piece of turkey liver and maybe some turkey heart and turkey kidney and unidentifiable turkey innards. but yeah, I really like that. And then cranberry sauce is interesting. We used to, when I was really little, we used to have the one out of the can. That I loved. I just loved the taste of it. I was like, yeah. But it was, looking back on it, it was odd because it was served. It was always sliced, which I guess meant it made it more dainty looking or something. But it was still like, this is still in the shape of a can. But eventually, and I don't know when my mother started doing this, eventually we moved to, she started making a cranberry orange relish that was a lot tartar, a lot less sweet. And fresh, because she used fresh cranberries and fresh oranges. And yeah, and that works really well. And I really like that. And then we'd have like some kind of sweet potato thing going on. Not mashed, but usually like chunks of sweet potatoes. Not with marshmallows, though. Like the marshmallows thing, I knew people did it. And I am forced to this day to make that with marshmallows in our house because that's what's demanded. I don't like it. I think it's way too sweet. I think it's just like sweet on sweet on sweet. But that, usually some kind of green bean thing, but not necessarily green bean casserole. I'm trying to think of what else was always a part of it. And then pie, pumpkin pie, and many times chocolate pecan pie.
Ooh, yeah, that sounds good.
The recipe came off a pack of German, Baker's German chocolate, or Baker's German chocolate. It was good. I mean, we would growing up in the South, football was really big. So football would be on, there'd be college games on, and then we'd, later in the day, whoever the Cowboys or Detroit Lions were playing would go on. Cause those were the two big kind of games around Thanksgiving. We might go outside and throw the football around or something after dinner. Mm-hmm. It was interesting because I don't think my Thanksgiving was much different than most other middle class white Protestant families' Thanksgiving. I think we all kind of had a similar experience with it.
Yeah.
There was nothing religious though.
No.
The only religious thing is there'd be a prayer. There'd be a prayer at the beginning of dinner.
Yeah, so that was what was interesting for me. That would be the only religious thing. And with my family, there was a divide. Like, so when you were talking about some of the things that your family would prepare, my mom's family is from the South, so she would bring cornbread stuffing, but the rest of the family would look at it like, ew. And so just like me and my mom and my brother would eat that, and I really liked it. And it would be like this weird divide, and like you talking about your own experience, I was like, oh yeah, there were some things that I like to eat. But the whole experience was weird because we would have this meal on the table that nobody really liked, I don't think. But then we would pray. We never prayed before we ate. And then suddenly on Thanksgiving, like, we have to say a prayer. And I'm like, what? Like, so it was not a religious holiday for us because I grew up going to Catholic school, but there was a prayer before it. And so when I was researching for today, I realized like, well, of course, like it all kind of clicked of like, oh, of course, like there's some really small leftover piece of what it originally was that gets brought into the 20th and 21st century. And that would be the little prayer before eating.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think there are two strains, right? There are two kind of threads that lead into contemporary Thanksgiving. So there's like the Puritan thread that we can talk about, but then there's also the older kind of harvest festival thread, right? That actually is even pre-Christian, right? It doesn't rely on Christianity to kind of be a thing. But the Puritan one is very infused with kind of Calvinist ideas. And that's the one kids, when they use, I don't know if kids still have like Thanksgiving pageants, but when they used to, that's the one they used to celebrate, where it was 1621.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the idea of the first Thanksgiving and as it being rooted in something that's very American, but when we dive into it deeper, it's like, well, it's not American at all, and it has other roots and it has other purposes, but I think the idea of it as a national holiday is something pretty new. And the idea of it as being one day that is celebrated, where back when Thanksgiving, the first Thanksgiving that we talk about, you're saying 1621, but you know, that date could be disputed or say it was done before or after, but days of Thanksgiving weren't just once a year, right?
Right.
You could have,
they can happen often,
a day of Thanksgiving anytime.
Yeah. I mean, do you want to run us through the narrative of that first Thanksgiving, 1621, like who the, like why they decided to have a Thanksgiving?
Well, it's, oh man, I don't, it's not like a run through thing really, is it? I mean, it's like the Puritans had a bounty.
Let's call them the Pilgrims. Let's talk about the Pilgrims.
Okay, the Pilgrims.
Think back to the way you were taught in school about how it happened.
Oh, you want me to say like the way I was taught in school or the real way?
Yes. Oh, yeah, the way I was taught in school.
Okay.
We are not talking about reality.
Okay, all right. So the way it's taught in school is that there's Pilgrims and they had all this food because they had really good luck that year. And they realized that they had some neighbors that were nearby, and they invited their neighbors, the Indians, to come over and have food. And then they like shook hands and they all sat down at a super long table, and they all had a great meal and fun together, and they hugged and became really good friends after they had this meal. And that didn't happen.
Didn't the Indians like help the pilgrims that summer and fall?
Well, they
like
helped them,
showed them how to plant corn.
Yeah, like as a welcoming kind of a thing. Like, we're right. So how glad you're here, neighbors. Yeah. We'll teach
how to
you
put
all
a fish.
Ways. Yeah.
Right. How to put a fish in with the seeds when you planted the corn and all this stuff. It was just a wonderful relationship, right? And this dinner is like this being thankful for
the culmination of their love for one another.
Right. And it's this moment of just harmony and joy and God shining down on the pilgrim endeavor in Plymouth.
Why and it's is complete it taught hokum. That way? Why is it taught that way? And when does it start to be taught that way?
Well,
those are the questions I wanted to
get
into.
Right. And I think the question is the same of why was the revolution taught for so long the way it was taught? Why is anything taught the way it's taught? And I think it was part of a broader national narrative, right? I think it was mythologizing this moment and minimizing any suffering or kind of destruction that comes out of it, and pointing back to a moment maybe where things were better was viewed as important. But I mean, let's talk about, so the Wampanoag are the people that Puritan, the pilgrims would have been interacting with.
And that's a really good point right there alone, because we never even are taught the name of the tribe. It's always just some unidentified tribe, just Indians, right? That's
I love when they're depicted as Plains Indians also.
Yeah, that's
and it's just like, right? And it's just like, okay,
it's
well,
like
these
not even
weren't
geographically.
Yeah, it's like these weren't Lakota, like these are. But I mean, so the Wampanoag, there's this contentious relationship, right? And I know I've been doing this a lot lately, but I want to recommend this. William Cronin's Changes in the Land. He talks about the land that the pilgrims come into and what it looks like. And, you know, I always tell my students to exercise this kind of practice of empathy with historical subjects. Try to imagine why they do the things they do and why they think those things are the correct choice. But I mean, you're a pilgrim and you've like come over on the Mayflower and you land, and you land in this place where it looks almost park-like. The undergrowth between the trees has been cleaned out. The trees are kind of spaced out somewhat. And in a pilgrim's mind, that almost seems like God is like prepared this land for you to settle
on. Yeah.
But that's not the reality, right? I mean, diseases had been devastating these coastal populations for decades, mm-hmm. Spreading out of kind of earlier contacts with the Spanish in the Southeast. And the Wampanoag and other people were aware of Europeans. They knew who Europeans were. And they also knew that usually interactions with Europeans ended poorly for non-Europeans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so there is a bit of truth to the Thanksgiving myth that the Wampanoag reached out to the English settlers as an opportunity to form an alliance because of this decimation, right? Because mm-hmm. they weren't reaching out because, oh, let's be friends, but it's like, let's survive. It wasn't
right. We are, need somebody to help us.
Yes.
And that's the thing. The English become embroiled very quickly in this conflict between the Wampanoag and other tribes. And this plays into the whole thing of kind of the Iroquois speaking peoples versus Huron speaking people. Mm-hmm. Kind of these large political alliances fighting one another.
Yeah. And they're, because it's not just the English who were there, there's French who were there, right? There are different countries, Europeans who were in the area. And a lot of native tribes tried to make alliances with the Europeans because they needed to they needed to survive. They're being decimated by diseases. They see these, there's an encroachment on their land. And it's almost like a, well, this is the only way we're going to survive is if we start trying to get along with some of these people around here. Otherwise, we're all going to be completely wiped out. It's not out of friendliness, right?
Right. So, I mean, that's the Wampanoag position, but for the Puritans / Pilgrims, in their head, they construct this reality where, again, this is God's providence. This is God setting things out for them,
mm-hmm.
right? And I do believe some of them mistook what the Wampanoags did as just reaching out for friendship. Because of why wouldn't you want to be friends with the Puritans?
Right. Well, and it's convenient to have this narrative to say, okay, this meal is now symbolic of your acceptance of colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you sat down with us, you said we're friends, we're in an alliance, you accept us taking over. You accept us taking your land. You accept our encroachment here because we're all just friends now. And it's there were so many moments where there were tensions, but alliances, but, you know, with all these clashes of cultures. And we kind of zero in on this one moment here in order to legitimize the American story, the American mythology, mm-hmm. the idea that, you know, that there weren't people here who were upset. With the encroachment on land that, well, no, we had this meal and everything was chill, right?
Right. And it stands in stark contrast to Cortez's conquest of Mexico, right? The English really buy into and help further this whole black legend about the Spanish, right? Where the Spanish came in and just killed indigenous people left mm-hmm. and right.
Mm-hmm.
And which isn't entirely false, but isn't the whole story. And the English really just portray themselves as trying to do something different.
Well, they're benevolent.
And right.
Neighborly.
But they're neighborly, but there are clear divisions between them.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the English, unlike the Spaniards and unlike the French, where the divisions aren't kind of policed, for the Puritans in New England, there is a clear rule that you are not meant to go interact intimately
mm-hmm.
with indigenous people, with the Wampanoag or anybody else, right? That to be English is to be English, and that means you cannot kind of intermingle.
Right.
And, I mean, this ends up causing a lot of conflict in New England, right? There's this series of wars that get fought that – really emerge out of this idea that first the English misunderstand the political situation they find themselves involved in. Second, the Wampanoag maybe assume the Puritans are going to fulfill their obligations out of this friendship consistently, which they don't. And finally, the English start to not even really differentiate amongst groups of Indians. I mean, is that fair to say they do that?
Yeah, they don't. And that carries over into our translation of what happened. And we have these problems all the time where we create monoliths out of distinct groups of people with distinct languages, cultures, traditions, and motivations. But to just say, well, it's all Native people. And we don't even
right.
we don't even differentiate tribe name. We don't even differentiate, you know, regionally. And when you're taught in school, it's interesting, like what you're saying about Plains Indians or something, right? It's just like, oh, Indians live in teepees. What? No.
Sure. A specific few groups at a specific place in a specific time. Sure. Time
for a specific reason. Yeah. And so I think that starts early where there's just this lumping together of people to say, they're all the same. They're all Native people. They're all the same. But I mean, I do remember, to be fair, I do remember, like, we had specific lessons in elementary school about, you know, the Iroquois lived here and they had these types of clothes and, you know, and we did go over certain tribes. I'm not going to completely drag my education, but for the most part, particularly in a discussion about Thanksgiving, there was no nuance to it. There was no nuance. And it was all to further this nationalistic agenda and this this cementing of the idea that you are here in this country, the United States of America exists because it was sanctioned. You know, like it was allowed and nobody was upset and there was nothing bad about it. And, you know, the land was mostly empty. And then there were some, you know, nice Indians nearby who helped us plant corn. You know, it starts really young of creating this foundational idea, the manifest destiny idea, right? That there's just this empty land and it was just being waiting to be filled with people.
It's providence.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this is the whole Puritan idea, right? The Puritans are Calvinist, right? So they have kind of very clear ideas of God's providence, right? God kind of putting out this path for them to follow. They have a choice to follow that, but the path is put out there by God if they want to follow it. And they really adhere to this idea and they look for signs constantly. I mean, go back to our episode, just to kind of self-promote here, go back to our episode on the Salem witch trials.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The Puritans are constantly looking for signs to kind of validate their relationship with God or confirm it, right? To confirm, are they actually doing what they're supposed to be doing? Or are they getting off track? Is there corruption in their community? All these things. But I wanted, before we get too much on, I wanted to comment on the thing about the Iroquois. Of course, you learned about the Iroquois because they set up an Iroquois confederacy that certainly seemed similar to European political alliances, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing is, that's the one group that maybe children do learn something about.
Well, we learned about Cherokee for similar reasons, because they started, you know, assimilating
the civilized tribes
into the courts and to try to fight for their lands, you know, through legal channels and things like that. But yeah, you're right. Those are the tribes you learn more about, because that important word, right, it's like, oh, well, that's civilized. And mm-hmm. just that alone is a huge problem when talking about the variance and the you know, the different motivations. And one thing I'll say too is that thinking about providence, they see that there's the leader of the Wampanoag comes forward and says, let's, you know, kind of create this alliancing. There was a lot of dissent within the tribe itself. Not all of the Wampanoag thought it was a good idea to go over and talk to the Europeans. And oftentimes we simplify the past so much that we forget, just thinking about our own time period, that everybody has their own unique opinion. Everybody has their own political mm-hmm. motivations. Everybody has their own economic motivations or whatever. And it's not any different for people living in that time period, for, you know, the Puritans in the time period, but also all these different native tribes and people where there was dissent within their own tribes.
This is a big thread that continues, right? Is this idea that this chief, there's the argument, okay, maybe you represent your specific group, but you do not represent Wampanoags in general.
Because so many Wampanoags knew that any alliance with Europeans was going to create more death, more disease, more encroachment on land, and they weren't wrong. That being said, they're in this impossible position. You know, you create the alliance and maybe you survive for a little while longer, or you don't create the alliance and you risk being, you know, war being waged against you if there is resistance, because we see that time and time again. So it's like leaders at this time are in this horrible position, you know, trying to make decisions what's best for their people. But it's not, there's no good decision to be made. And to ignore the nuance of that, I think, is damaging for us understanding Thanksgiving. And I think it's especially damaging when you have school-age children and you keep relaying this myth because it doesn't, it kind of lays the groundwork for not, for people not being able to understand history. I have college students who just like to relay events. This happened, then this happened, then this happened on this date and that date. It's like, that's not history. That's not talking about history. That's not analyzing what's happening. That's You're ignoring the details, the significance of events, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, so let's talk about kind of as this event in 1621 starts to become mythologized, because the moment it happens, it starts to be portrayed by certain groups one way and other groups a different way. So soon after this event in the autumn of 1621, evidently a 3-day event of some type.
It sounds like it was kind of lit, you know?
Sounds pretty awesome if the accounts are to be believed. But Edward Winslow writes a letter back to England where he kind of recounts it, and he says, "And God be praised, we had a good increase. Our harvest being gotten in, our governor sent 4 men on fowling so that we might after a special manner rejoice together. These things I thought good to let you understand, that you might on our behalf give God thanks who hath dealt so favorably with us." And this is kind of the Puritan Thanksgiving starts to crystallize here, right? So this gets shared back in England, and it actually gets shared pretty widely around England and around Puritan communities, right? Because it's kind of confirmation that God favors the Puritans and likes what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. But it doesn't become cemented as like an annual celebration.
No, not at all, right?
No, there was this one moment that was really significant.
Harvest feasts are generally annual, right?
Yes, yes. But not based or steeped in this event.
Right. So, I mean, you have these competing things about kind of this older idea of a harvest feast, something that's pre-Christian, right? It's not related to Christianity at all. But then you have this kind of very Puritan version, which is I'd call it a Christian resignification of the harvest festival.
Yes, which Christians tend to do with many festivals, right? The bringing the tree in for Christmas, that's a pagan thing, yes. Right? Yes. So the Christians love to repurpose holidays because, you know, they want to celebrate.
Bunnies and eggs.
Which I still think that South Park has the best explanation as to why there are eggs on Easter.
Hippitus hoppitus.
Sorry, yeah.
I'm sorry. Hillary and I both have an obsession with South Park. Watch the Easter episode. It is really funny. But I mean, this is, so you've got this older kind of pagan holiday, and now you have this Christian resignification. But for the most part, that doesn't really get standardized, surprisingly, from the kind of the first half of the 17th century up until 1777. It's periodically celebrated, but it's not really anything coherent or cohesive. It's also a very New England thing.
Mm-hmm. When it's not thematic and it's not based on the first Thanksgiving, people aren't every time that they're – and that's the thing too. I guess just breaking down the word, it's really just a day that certain, you know, leaders would set aside to give thanks. Like, oh, something good happened, so today we're having a Thanksgiving. And sometimes it could mean fasting.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it didn't mean feasting. A lot of times these days of thanks, particularly if they're rooted in a religious ceremony or religiously, oftentimes these things are fasting days, not feasting days. And even when it's picked up again by, I think George Washington declared a Thanksgiving, the Continental Congress declared Thanksgiving in 1777, but it's not a yearly tradition. Adams and Monroe declare it, but it's not usually up to, you know, it's not necessarily connected to the 1621 feast with the Wampanoag.
Right. I mean, that 1777 one really has to do with the Revolution.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is raging, the war, right, at this time.
The proclamation recommended servile labor in such recreations, although at other times innocent, may be unbecoming the purpose of this appointment and should be omitted on so solemn occasion. So it's kind of a very grim kind of reflection and remembrance on the kind of the terrible situation they find themselves in.
Yeah. And it's not about pumpkin pie at all at that moment.
It is not about pumpkin pie, nor is it about cornbread stuffing. And, you know, by the period right after the War of 1812, it just kind of falls out of, it's not even really mentioned.
No, no. And then in the 1820s, there's a campaign started by Godey's a woman.
Godey's Ladies book, right? I mean, that's, I love this. This magazine, I'm obsessed with two 19th century publications, Godey's Ladies book and the National Police Gazette.
I like the National Police Gazette and I like Harper's Bazaar.
Oh, I love Harper's Bazaar too. That's, they've got some of the greatest books.
I love 19th century magazines. Like, what is the matter with us?
But these, but I mean, this is the power of print culture, right? I mean, it's, we have people complaining about the media's influence today, but print culture, particularly these magazines, become so powerful in 19th century America.
Mm-hmm.
And because everybody wants to see what they should do. Yeah, go ahead and talk about it.
Yeah, so Sarah Joseph Hale in the 1820s, in 1827, she starts this campaign, a conservative campaign, to make Thanksgiving a national holiday. A little side note about her, she's the person who wrote Mary Had a Little Lamb, which I love. That little fact. But she's campaigning all the time, you know, Thanksgiving should be a national holiday. Thanksgiving should be a national holiday. And she's beating this drum. And there's, you know, these women's magazines. And I think it has a lot to do what we talked about last week about this budding cult of domesticity, right? Of like, we need to have this national feast or holiday that's, you know, it brings the nation together. And we all set aside this time to be thankful. And still, even at this time, it's still not related to the 1621 Wampanoag and Puritan dinner. It's not at that time. And it's still very much rooted in just, well, sometimes we have days of thanks. And it's not until 1863 that Sarah Joseph Hale is actually able to convince Abraham Lincoln that there should be a national celebration of Thanksgiving. And if you know, 1863, you're in the midst of the Civil War. And she makes this argument like, hey, this will be a great way to unify everybody if we have a national holiday. It doesn't work. But that's when she finally succeeds. So she takes, you know, decades to be able to say that there should be a national holiday. But it's not until even decades after that, that we start to see more discussion about Thanksgiving as being rooted in the colonial era.
Well, I mean, it's so 1863, Lincoln declares two Thanksgivings that year.
Yeah, there's one in August.
For Gettysburg.
Yeah. And that's a day of thanks for winning the Battle of Gettysburg.
And then the other is the last Thursday in November. And that's the interesting thing is that for Lincoln, it is all about, I mean, when Sarah Hale like talks about uniting the country, arguing it'll unite the country, I think she does mean the North. I don't think she thinks it's going to unite the South because Thanksgiving just has not up to this point ever really taken a hold in the South. It's not really something they do.
I'm glad they did come in and invent the cornbread stuffing, though. I do appreciate
it. I am too, right? But yeah, it's not until the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century that suddenly people are like, well, you know what? This has a lot to do with that feast in 1621, much more than it does with Lincoln declaring two Thanksgivings in the midst of the Civil War. And I would like to make an argument as to why they focus back on 1621.
I would like to, too, and maybe we're in agreement. Go.
I think a lot of it has to do with there's this period at the end of the 19th century where there's a rallying around recasting the Civil War as this lost cause, trying to unite the North and the South, and moving the origin of Thanksgiving from the Civil War context back to 1621 theoretically brings all Americans, and by all Americans, I actually mean white Americans, because that's all they cared about, back together culturally.
Yeah, I could see that as being like a let's all just get together and we're all friends again sort of argument. What about the closing of the frontier?
I think that's another important thing, right? I mean, yeah. I think it allays collective guilt about what Americans maybe fear they've done to some people.
Yeah. So the late 19th century, you have a complete expansion across what is now referred to as the continental United States. There are Europeans in every single facet, and all these states are coming into being. And you finally have what we know now as a more like cohesive United States of America forming at this time. And I think creating this national mythology becomes even more pressing in the late 19th century to say, hey, we've got a history that goes all the way back to 1621. And you have the closing of the wars that are going on between still, I mean, you study this, wars going on between Native tribes and the United States after the Civil War. And I think it's almost like by the 1890s, when you start getting this focus on the 1621 feast, that they're almost trying to shut that chapter. Is that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think
they are. I think they're trying to recast Anglo-Indian relationships as having this ideal moment back in 1621 and
there's an underlying positivity to it, and that we need to just get back to that moment of harmony.
Even when things got messy, there was always this respect the English descendants had for Indians because we were friends.
False.
I mean, it's very paternalistic.
Yes.
But then I think there's a third reason. I mean, I think that's a great reason as well. I think the third reason is it becomes a way to Americanize the vast number of immigrants that are suddenly entering the country.
Yes. And how do you do that, though? Through education. If you were to ask my husband, why is this the case? He always says, well, it's an education story. You start to see compulsory education happening more so in the late 19th century. And there are Americanization programs that take, you know, form in the elementary education sort of realm. And the idea to Americanize, to create mythology, to create a history that everyone's just kind of feels good about is really important at this time.
And you can secularize 1621 to some ways. You can abstract it, and instead of, I mean, you can still call them Puritans or pilgrims or whatever, but you can take the religion and say, look, they were escaping religious persecution.
Well, and that is the first time really that it is that we start considering it secular, because it was very clearly not in the 18th century and into the 19th century, because Thomas Jefferson refused to have Thanksgiving as a national holiday, or he refused to declare a Thanksgiving, because you had Washington, Adams, and Monroe do it, but not Jefferson, right? You had 1, 2, and 4 do it, but not 3. And his reasoning for that was because he was strictly against church and state mingling. And he very much saw Thanksgiving as a religious holiday. But by the 19th century, they're able to secularize it and say, no, it's an American holiday. It's not a Christian holiday.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
I mean, I think the reason Jefferson really hates it the most is because Adams liked it.
Could be. That could be too.
But it's interesting
that's what he cites as his reason, right? And
no, I think it is.
So firmly, no, this is a religious holiday. We wouldn't say that now. You wouldn't
Not
ask anybody, you know, they wouldn't say that Thanksgiving is a religious holiday. They're just like, oh, it's an American holiday. But it's
going
a Canadian
to-
holiday too, so.
Right. Going to a worship service is not part of how most people celebrate Thanksgiving.
No, unless you're my grandma who goes to church for everything.
But I mean, this idea of Americanizing immigrants, I think, is a really important thing, because this is when kind of the contours of what a proper Thanksgiving should be really start to solidify.
Yes.
And turkey becomes kind of the centerpiece.
But there was no turkey at the first Thanksgiving that we know of.
There's we no know that,
evidence I mean, that there was turkey.
So Winslow mentioned fowl.
Turkey.
Could have been some ducks. Could have been a turkey. Could have been some poor Canada goose.
I heard that there was maybe some shellfish.
I've heard lobster.
Yeah, lobster. That's exactly.
Yeah.
That seems really weird. But you know what? In the Northeast, that oftentimes there is lobster as an appetizer for Thanksgiving still to this day, like dips and stuff.
Yeah. I think this idea that turkey and roast are kind of these centerpiece meat dishes have a long history of occupying the place of prominence at celebration tables, right? Mm-hmm. So they're tapping into a much longer kind of idea, but they standardize it as Thanksgiving. And it's interesting because it becomes a way to claim membership in the United States of America. The fourth Thursday in November, you have this feast with your family, and at the middle of the table is a turkey.
Mm-hmm. Now, which Benjamin Franklin wanted to be the national bird.
Right, which would be weird because
no, it's not. I think it's viciously American.
Should we eat the American bird then?
Well, that would be very Catholic, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing though is that so the turkey becomes a centerpiece, but what I really find interesting, a lot of other standards at a Thanksgiving dinner that we mentioned, and you did not grow up in the South, right?
No.
That we mentioned, actually, a lot of these emerge from the South.
Mm-hmm.
So you get like New England dishes, you get Southern dishes, and it's an interesting. I mean, there's some interesting symbolism going on there, but
I started making mac and cheese with my Thanksgiving meal because I realized that was like a staple. Because a lot of people in the South, it's like a staple for Thanksgiving.
We had this argument. Years ago, I think you asked me about it. I was like, we would never have macaroni and cheese.
Well, neither would I. But like, I'm always looking for an excuse to have baked macaroni and cheese. So,
well, yeah. I mean, our
dish, you know what? It is kind of a carb overkill. Like, if you have like mashed potatoes and cornbread stuffing and macaroni,
we never had mashed potatoes.
Out of control at that point. No, you didn't have mashed potatoes with your turkey.
You had sweet potatoes and you had the stuffing.
That's sensible.
Those were your carbs. But until dessert, and then dessert was just like carb overload.
Then it's a lot. Now, to get back, though, to some traditions that come around Thanksgiving, is you're talking about the food on the table, and it can vary by region. And I was reading that, like, in the Southwest, sometimes people will put, like, chilies into their turkey and stuff like that to help, like, you know, like, aromatics mm-hmm. and stuff like that. But the other
I've heard really people put oysters in their dressing.
Oh, no. That's not allowed. The other center
you think about,
though, and you mentioned this, is football.
Right.
And 1876 is when you see the first Thanksgiving football game, Yale versus Princeton. And this is – so what I would say is before Thanksgiving was secularized – as an American tradition and not a religious tradition, football actually predated that. It's been more about football for longer than it has been about Americans for longer. Mm-hmm. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. I went to, back when I lived back East, I went to a Harvard-Princeton football game.
That sounds really fancy.
Yes, and it was one of the most boring things I've ever been to in my entire life. A good friend and I went, and we were like, both from the South, so we were like rooting, like Southerners root for football, and it was just not looked well upon. Like, they were just like, who are these two people? We're like, go Princeton, kill them, blah, blah, blah. and people are looking at us like, what are they doing?
No.
It was so boring, too. It was so, oh my God, it was so boring. Yeah, if you're a big football fan, treat yourself and go watch an Ivy League football game. They're hilarious.
I've never been or watched one, but I can imagine it's rather stuffy.
Yeah. So, very different than like Ole Miss would celebrate a football game.
I mean, they wear like suits and stuff to the game.
But they get rowdy at the game as well, though. So
yeah. I've not been to one of those games either. Shame on me, I suppose.
So, yeah. So you've got football, but you've also got other things, right? You've got parades. Parades.
So the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade becomes a tradition in the 1920s. The first Macy's Thanksgiving Parade, though, didn't have balloons like we see now, but they had actual animals from the Central Park Zoo in the parade.
Yeah.
You know that? Isn't that insane? They were like taking lions out into the streets or something instead of balloons. But now, I mean, they did have floats, but now, you know, the Thanksgiving Day Parade, Macy's Thanksgiving Parade starts in the 20s, and that's a huge tradition. What do you have to say about the day that Thanksgiving is celebrated? Because I think we have a nice segue into discussing the how it becomes American in the late 19th century. But then I feel it's really solidified under FDR's administration. And I think you have something to say about that. Yeah.
So even going back to kind of Puritan kind of New England celebrations, Thanksgiving days could not occur on Sundays.
No.
They were kind of bonus Sabbath days. So there's already a definition that can occur on that. And pretty early on, Thursday gets settled on. And in the throes of the Great Depression, FDR actually moves Thanksgiving up 1 week. So instead of it being the fourth Thursday of the month of November, he moves it to the third because he wants it to spur retail sales. He wants to kind of, in the midst of the Great Depression, give kind of retailers an extra week of Christmas shopping. Because traditionally, by 39.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's right. 39 is when he moves it, and 41 he moves it back.
42.
No, 41 he signs it.
Maybe then the next year it becomes that official.
That really pisses off football
because they already had their schedules for the season, right? And they're just like, excuse me.
But I mean, by 39, the Friday after Thanksgiving had become a fairly big deal for shopping. It was the kickoff for the Christmas shopping season. And
that becomes really American, right? Like when you start infusing capitalism and consumerism, it is now officially an American holiday, right?
Yeah. This has nothing to do with religion at this point.
Nothing to do with religion. It's the religion of capitalism, really.
Right. Nor does it have anything to do with celebrating friendship or imagined friendship between indigenous people and colonists. It is about buying stuff and eating.
Again,
I mean, what do you think about
American?
So Black Friday becomes kind of this big thing. You go out and you kind of go shopping and fight crowds and all this stuff. What do you think about the recent trend of places being open Thursday for shopping?
I mean, it's just insane to me because it totally violates the purpose of having days, right? Like, why even have Thanksgiving anymore?
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to force people to go to work, because that's what I find really disgusting about it, is like the people who have to go work at, you know, I don't know, Best Buy, where you're busting down the doors to get a TV for $20 off. Like, they want to go eat with their families too, because the fact that it has turned into just about consumerism and it's not about thanks and it's not about family and it's not about any of that, that is really sad and it's classist because there's this expectation that like, well, you're not important enough to be able to celebrate this national holiday. You have to go to work. And I don't like it. I mean, because then by that, you could just keep pushing it back further and further and further. And there's an attempt to do this because I see Christmas stuff up in October, you know, like at stores. There's this idea that we have to keep shopping sooner and sooner and sooner. Hallmark comes out with their yearly Christmas line in July. So we're constantly trying to push it so that way we spend more. And I don't know, it really bugs me. And I've never participated in Black Friday because I would rather pay more than punch someone in the face for 20% off. You know, it's insane.
Yeah. I think you and I, as college professors, we are never going to be asked to work on Thanksgiving Day.
And that's a privilege. That's what I'm saying.
Right. And I think that's the thing. Yeah. So then we can construct our Thanksgiving Day however we want. Whereas if you're kind of a retail minimum wage worker, you're really at the mercy of when you get put on a schedule. And it used to be virtually all stores were closed. Virtually all restaurants were closed, right? That this was a time where everybody nationwide could actually take the day off, stay at home, stay with family and friends, and do this kind of communal dining thing, right?
Yeah.
Communal celebration over food. I don't think it's about that anymore, though.
No, it's not about that anymore. But one thing I will say is I know people who they go out to eat on Thanksgiving. And I think
you used to not be able to do that.
I think it's awful though, right? I mean, you're asking somebody to come and serve you Thanksgiving dinner when they don't get to go have it with their family. But then I know people who are elderly who they can't make dinner or they don't have family around. Like, it's complicated. And see, there again goes back to the discussion of everybody has their own motivations and circumstances, and it's complicated because I can have that conversation and acknowledge that, hey, I think everybody should be able to have the day off and be able to spend it with their families having a meal at home. I also understand maybe not everybody can afford to have a meal at their home. Maybe going out to Cracker Barrel and having the Thanksgiving meal is far more economical for some people than it is to get all the ingredients for their house, you know? But I guess to get to your original question, it's like, no, it's really not about family and gathering and thanks anymore. It's about ushering in the consumer season of Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like the starting point of Christmas.
But this shift to consumerism is not a shift away from religion to consumerism, right? Thanksgiving is fundamentally the way it is celebrated in the United States from 1777 on, religion gets taken out very quickly. And it is viewed as a secular holiday. And that's kind of as it is formed into what we kind of idealize as the perfect Thanksgiving. It is a very secular holiday.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's meant to be something anyone, no matter what their religion is, can participate in.
Well, and you participate in it to be American.
Right.
It's almost because like 4th of July.
Right. Because I am a little disturbed when I see people trying to kind of reimagine Thanksgiving as this deeply religious event. And it's like, well, no, it's just not. Just like I want to inform people about the long history of Christmas when they argue about Christmas as this kind of deeply religious celebration. And I'm like, well, kind of, but Oliver Cromwell's very religious, and in the English Civil War, in the aftermath, he outlaws Christmas because he views it as simply a pagan celebration.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I mean, maybe that's one reaction people are having to the gross consumerism of Thanksgiving now is they want to just say, well, no, it's religious, so we shouldn't do that. Whereas I think, I think there's another truth to it, which is it's about community thanks. For kind of whatever.
There's a lot of pushback though to Thanksgiving that I'm hearing now that's related to Columbus Day, right? That a lot of people celebrate Thanksgiving by going to what's considered the original site, and it's a national day of mourning for some mm-hmm. people because that feast, that 1621 feast, whether in reality or not, to them marks this point. Because it's obviously there's not one point where European incursion becomes a problem. I mean, it's been since they came, right? But right. They will mark this day not as a day of thanks and gratitude and happiness, but as a day of mourning because it is so – that idea of Thanksgiving as being this communal, exciting, yay, we're friends moment has been damaging to their communities for decades. And so there are a lot of Native communities who they say, we're not celebrating Thanksgiving because we're not very thankful for what happened to our culture and our tribe and our tribes and our land and all of that. Like, we're not going to celebrate colonialism. We're not celebrating the incursion onto Native land. We're not celebrating the underhandedness. And we're not going to fall into this nationalistic mythology to make everybody else feel comfortable. That's a lot of the pushback I see right now. And it's connected to the Columbus Day pushback, where people are looking back to the roots and saying, hey, this is kind of a messed up thing. And I find myself, you know, now with two kids, how do I talk to them about Thanksgiving has become on my, it's on my mind now. What is Thanksgiving? How am I going to teach them about Thanksgiving? What are the important things I need to relay to them?
Mm-hmm. Just another shameless self-promotion. If you want to hear more about our conversation about Columbus Day, we do have an episode about that.
We do.
I mean, it's complicated, right? Because I think an easy answer is you just start with Lincoln and kind of move forward from there and kind of make an argument all the Pilgrim stuff is tacked on later, and there's a lot of problems with that. So maybe if you strip all of that out of there, but at the same time, I think if you strip the Pilgrim slant out of it, then you actually do lose the opportunity to talk about the treatment of people like the Wampanoag. You know, when we're, and it ties into your whole thing about anxieties about if I go out to eat or if I go shopping, am I forcing someone else to give things up so I can be thankful? Mm-hmm. I think that's the thing. It's very much a thing of, do I have the privilege to be thankful while other people have to give things up to allow that to happen for me? And, you know, the Pilgrims imagine it a certain way. And we can look back on that today and see the way they imagine it's really flawed. First, they just fundamentally misunderstand the world they're in. But second, they really take advantage of a group of people who are very vulnerable at that moment.
Right. Because and only extending friendship out of desperation.
Right. They're basically trapped between larger groups and then this group of English settlers who've landed, and they kind of make a choice of who they want to ally with. I think that's an important question to think about. And, you know, I know it's interesting. I wonder what conversations are going to be like around Thanksgiving tables in a, you know, this year.
Well, hopefully there aren't any. I hope people are not having gatherings.
Well, but I think they are. I think they're going to be. I mean, it's, I don't see people as capable of containing themselves.
I judge them.
Huh?
I judge them.
I do too.
Send me an email if you're
But, you know, I think even if they do virtual gatherings or whatever, I wonder what those conversations are going to be like, because I think a lot of Americans in the midst of COVID-19, they wonder, is there anything really to be thankful for right now?
Mm. It's interesting to think about. Yeah. Well, real quick before we wrap up, will there be a turkey parting ceremony this year?
I feel like you're baiting me to say something very political.
I know a certain turkey that wants to be pardoned.
Yeah. Zing.
So that leads us to discuss, though, our next, we wanted to have an episode. I don't know if it's going to be our next episode or not, but where we wanted to like have a little bit of a debate and discussion about worst presidents in history.
I think we are doing that next, right?
I wanted to point out quickly, though, that the turkey pardoning thing, that's kind of a new thing. George H.W. Bush in 1989 is the first president to have an actual ceremony, although Kennedy, I think, sent the turkey to like a wildlife thing. And there have been other presidents who have done something similar, but the ceremonial aspect of it is quite new. And that's the first one is in 1989. So I do wonder if there'll be a ceremony this year. And again, great segue into discussing presidents for our next episode. And I did want to quickly tell everybody that only male turkeys gobble. I really wanted to let everyone know that.
Do we? I should not. Do we eat male turkeys or female turkeys?
That I don't know. I would assume both, but maybe not. That I don't know.
I don't think so. I don't think so, because chickens we usually eat just chickens, hens. Not roosters. Yeah, we eat hens, not roosters. Roosters are generally killed at birth.
That's sad.
Because it's sad, but you only need so many roosters. Mm-hmm. And roosters actually cause a lot of problems if you have multiple.
But yeah, Well, they're very noisy. I'll have to look at what we eat. Typically, if we eat.
I know turkeys are supposed to be really stupid.
Hey.
Like if it rains and turkeys are outside, that they will drown. That they'll like look up at the sky. Yeah, and
they're I want to be in charge of my destiny. I don't want you killing me. I'll do this myself. How dare you?
Anyway, I think we'll end it there. Thanks for joining us. This has been a fun conversation. Hopefully it's made you think a little bit about Thanksgiving and why we celebrate it, and maybe some issues, maybe some non-political stuff to bring up if you are in fact gathering with family or friends, or hopefully just kind of Zoom giving Z with them, or whatever we would call it.
Yes. So however you celebrate, if you do or you don't, I hope you do have a great next Thursday. And we are very happy to be back on a weekly schedule. But obviously next Thursday we won't be doing an episode, but maybe we'll do it Wednesday. But we do hope you join us next week for our next episode of An Incomplete History.
All right. Until next time, I'm Jeff.
And I'm Hillary.